Welcome to the Heart of Our Messianic Ministries audio presentation of the devotional study series entitled The First Regathering, Modern Israel. In this portion of our study, Heart of Our Messianic Ministries director, Pastor Bob Morris, will continue tracing important events in the history of the modern state of Israel. Pastor Bob will discuss the 1958 war with Egypt, as well as the 1967 Six-Day War, which resulted in Israeli capture of the Sinai Peninsula, the Golan Heights, and the West Bank of the Jordan River. Following the teaching session, you'll be given information explaining how to contact Heart of Our Messianic Ministries with your questions and to order additional resources. Now, let's begin lesson number 13. Here's Pastor Bob Morris.
Well, the year is 1956, and we're in the middle of looking at the Sinai campaign, that war that Israel fought in 1956. This is lesson number 13 of our class, The First Regathering, Modern Israel. Now, let's, by matter of review, as we get into lesson 13 here, let me recall that the 1956 Sinai campaign actually began a little bit earlier. It began in actually in March 1954, when Gamal Abd al-Nasser became premier of of Egypt. He then began exploring the possibilities of obtaining military equipment from the Soviet bloc, from the communist bloc, and Moscow was very pleased to do so, and therefore never failed to disguise its hostility toward Israel. In 1953, Moshe Dayan had been appointed chief of staff of the Israeli army, and the IDF, under his leadership, had become a very hard-hitting and aggressive force. And this brings us up to where we left off last lesson. It's 1953. In 1953, the Egyptian Coast Guard unit at Ras Nasrani closed off Israeli shipping through the Strait of Tiran to the south of Israel. And then in September of 1955, the Egyptians turned back the vessels of other nations bound for Israel's port of Eilat. So between 1953 and 1955, the Egyptians began to turn up the heat on Israel and try to close off shipping to the nation. In 1953, Ben-Gurion, October 22, 1953, Ben-Gurion, looking ahead, ordered Moshe Dayan to make preparations for capturing the Strait of Tiran. It was shortly after that Nasser issued his challenge. On July 26, he stated that the Suez Canal would be nationalized. Its future revenues would be applied to the construction of the Aswan Dam, and that Britain would no longer have control over the Suez Canal. Britain was most directly affected by this decision by Nasser, along with France, because Britain owned a controlling interest in the Suez Canal. About a quarter, about 25% of British imports passed through the Suez Canal, and one-third of the ships using the waterway were British, 33%. And not only was there an economic and a political loss envisioned by Britain, but Britain's general prestige in the Arab world was threatened as well, and Britain was in no position to accept this affront. So Anglo-French military preparations began to gain momentum. Britain and France brought the issue to the UN, and the Soviets vetoed any meaningful resolution of censure against Egypt. On June 19th, Nasser made his intentions toward Israel very clear in a public speech. He said, quote, "We must be strong in order to regain the rights of the Palestinians by force." Abd al-Hakim Amir, the commander-in-chief of the Egyptian army, informed his troops on July 15th, about a month later, "The hour is approaching when we will stand in the front ranks of the battle against imperialism and its Zionist ally." Ben-Gurion knew that he had to break the Egyptian blockade. He only needed a decisive moment to act, and France supplied the opportunity. The French leadership was interested in a very carefully structured, two-pronged offensive against Nasser. They suggested an Israeli ground attack through Sinai that would enable a British and French paratroop assault on the canal zone itself. Now, the eventual final strategy was developed by Moshe Dayan. Dayan proposed that Israel would carry out a limited offensive, more than a raid, but less than a war, an operation that would be interpreted as threatening the canal and justifying Allied intervention to safeguard it. Israel would strike first on October 29th. They would drop paratroopers east of the canal area, and they would announce the operation over the radio. Britain and France would then address a joint ultimatum to Israel and to Egypt, telling them to cease military activity. Israel would accept the ultimatum. It would not be obligated to actually observe the ceasefire until its troops advanced to a line 10 miles east of the canal area. In fact, they agreed the Israelis would have 12 hours to reach that point. And Egypt would most certainly reject the very, very discriminatory Allied conditions. And when they rejected them, at this point, British and French air forces would attack Egyptian airfields. They would destroy Nasser's planes on the ground, and that would remove the fear of Israeli cities being bombed, and that would simultaneously eliminate any threat against the Anglo-French landings. And finally, Allied troops would land along the canal and seize the waterway. This operation, this plan, was dubbed Operation Kadesh. It went exactly as planned. And the world was outraged at Britain, France, and Israel. 1956, on November 2nd, 1956, the General Assembly of the UN approved the United States resolution for an immediate ceasefire and the withdrawal of all occupying forces from Egyptian territory. On November 4th, the General Assembly voted to create the United Nations Emergency Force, UNEF, and that would separate the combatants along the Suez Canal and elsewhere in the Sinai. On November 4th, the Israeli government announced its willingness to accept the General Assembly's ceasefire resolution. Now, the acceptance was conditional on Egypt's declaration of willingness to do six things. Number one, to accept the ceasefire. Egypt needed to end the state of war with Israel. Thirdly, Israel demanded that Egypt terminate all guerrilla operations. Fourthly, Israel demanded that Egypt immediately enter into peace negotiations with Israel. Fifthly, they said that Egypt needed to cease their economic boycott of Israel. And sixth, that Egypt needed to lift the blockade against Israeli shipping. Now, the initial UN efforts were aimed at removing the French and British troops, French and British presence at the canal zone. And eventually, on December 22nd, the last British and French troops left the canal zone. The new General Assembly, there was a new General Assembly resolution on January 7, 1957, that demanded instant Israeli evacuation, and the Israelis pulled back, grudgingly allowing UNEF forces to fill the vacuum. Eventually, a formula was designed that put the UNEF in both Gaza and Sharm el-Sheikh. This formula included assurance that the two sides would, number one, the two sites would be garrisoned exclusively by the UNEF, that's Gaza and Sharm el-Sheikh, and number two, that the UNEF would safeguard life and property in the two areas and develop strategic plans for coping with the refugee problem. Thirdly, and finally, the UNEF would remain in Gaza and Sharm el-Sheikh for whatever length of time was required to achieve a permanent settlement between Egypt and Israel. That was the eventual formula that came about. Well, there was a little question that the campaign of 1956 had fulfilled its principal goal in advancing Israel's security. The Gulf of Aqaba was now open, and it would remain open for 11 years. And those 11 years were very important in the history of the modern state. Those 11 years were all that was needed to establish Israel's trade relationships with the Orient, to inaugurate a series of pipelines that transformed the little republic into one of the major oil depots between Iran and Europe, and to develop an infrastructure that launched Israel on a period of its most impressive economic growth and diplomatic influence. From November 1956 on, by universal recognition, The Jewish state had established itself at last as a factor to be reckoned with, indeed a sovereign entity to be treated with care and respect by the councils of the nations. As we move to 1961, one of the key events in 1961 was the arrest and execution of Adolf Eichmann in Israel. Let's move to 1964. In 1964, the National Water Carrier was constructed, carrying water from the north of Israel down to the south, to the Negev, a very, very important and key water supply and infrastructure program for the state of Israel. Let's move on to 1967. In 1967, we come to the Six-Day War. So Israel was growing in economic power and in strength from 1956 to 1967. That was just a fact of life in the Middle East. But Arab hatred of Israel was growing at the same route. By 1965, the Syrian regime had allowed its 47-mile border with Israel to become the Middle East's single most explosive boundary. Nowhere were Israeli citizens more vulnerable to attack than along the border with Syria. Along the main DMZ area, Syrian guns were positioned on the Golan Heights, and they dominated the Hula Valley below. They fired on the Hula Valley, and the firing from the Golan became so persistent that the Israelis used armored tractors as standard equipment. So the confrontation along the Israeli-Syrian border was escalating. It was escalating into prolonged artillery duels and aerial dogfights by 1965. The Syrian government was determined to make active use of the Palestinian refugees as well. During 1964, an assembly of Palestinian Arabs was convened in the Hashemite Jerusalem, in Jordanian-owned Jerusalem, Jordanian-dominated Jerusalem. And in 1964, from the proceedings of this group, emerged a very significant organization called the Palestine Liberation Organization, or the PLO. There was a rival and even more radical Palestinian group in Syria called the Fatah, the Arab Liberation Movement. It had been organized several years earlier by veterans of the Mufti's Arab Higher Committee. So the Syrian troops were ensconced in the Golan, and they shelled and mortared Israeli farm settlements on the Hula Valley below. And Fatah guerrillas were laying repeated ambushes for Israeli army patrols and inflicting numerous casualties. Then in 1966, Nasser signed a new defense pact with the Soviet Union. Under its terms, the Russians were given naval facilities at Mediterranean and Red Sea ports. Three airports were also placed at the disposal of the Soviets. In return, Moscow undertook to increase its shipments of arms and technicians to Egypt. By April 1967, there could be little question that the deteriorating border situation with Syria was electric with danger. Fatah infiltration raiders were crossing over with greater frequency, and each time they were accompanied by larger numbers of Syrian regular army troops. By May 11th, Jerusalem notified the Security Council that unless Syrian provocation ended, the Israeli government regarded itself as, quote, fully entitled to act in self-defense. At that point, deeply alarmed for the security of their Arab protege, the Russians took their most calamitous misstep since they began to intrude into the Middle East. On May 12, 1967, the Soviet ambassador in Cairo wired Moscow that today we passed on to the Egyptian authorities information concerning the massing of Israeli troops on the northern frontier for a surprise attack on Syria. Now this was a report to Cairo, a report to the Egyptian protege there. It was a report to Cairo, and it was entirely false. Nasser then agreed to dispatch a series of military missions to Syria. They were taken to the Syrian southern frontier with Israel, and the Egyptian visitors were not impressed by the evidence they found of so-called Israeli concentrations. So they saw quite clearly that this report of an Israeli buildup was not true. But Nasser decided to let the crisis escalate. And his reason was based on other factors. On May 15, Cairo announced a state of military emergency and sent two armored divisions moving through the boulevards of Cairo in a very showy way. And then they crossed the Suez into the Sinai Peninsula. On the night of May 16th, Nasser suddenly gave orders for the 3,400-man UNEF force near Gaza to redeploy in encampments within the Gaza Strip itself. The UN would not accept any half measures. Either the UNEF accomplished its mission without reservation, or it would be withdrawn altogether from Egypt. The UN Secretary General was Outant. He had just dislodged the stone that made the avalanche inevitable. On the afternoon of May 17th, after a series of lengthy cabinet meetings, the Egyptian government called the Secretary General's hands. It notified him that it was ordering a complete UNEF evacuation from Egyptian territory and from the Gaza Strip. This flew in the face of the fact that General Assembly resolution of November 4th, 1956, meant that the UNEF could not be withdrawn without the consent of the General Assembly. On May 18, 1967, Outant met urgently with delegates of the seven countries whose troops served in the United Nations forces. It was then that the Secretary General learned, much to his dismay, that these representatives, following the lead of India and Yugoslavia, were determined to recall their soldiers at any cost, and under no circumstances would their governments risk the lives of their troops in the Middle East. Outant was persuaded that further discussions were useless, and he remained oblivious to appeals from the United States and appeals from Israel not to capitulate to Nasser's demands. But late that day, the blue-helmeted UNEF garrisons evacuated their positions, and the Egyptian troops and heavy equipment immediately moved in. Then, an Egyptian task force suddenly ordered the evacuation of the tiny UNEF company at Sharm el-Sheikh. Sharm el-Sheikh guarded the Strait of Tehran. As a result, then, of Outant's unwillingness to invoke the full range of United Nations procedures, the UNEF collapsed like a house of cards. And with it collapsed the world body's most impressive peacekeeping achievement to date. And so three Egyptian divisions and more than 600 tanks began fanning out through the Sinai Peninsula. At the same time, the Damascus regime mobilized 50 cadet battalions, and the Iraqi brigades moved out toward the frontier of Jordan. The governments of Kuwait, Yemen, and Algeria announced their readiness to dispatch troops and planes to Syria and Egypt. Now, as it developed, the afternoon of May 17th was the turning point of the Middle East crisis. Until then, a retreat without loss of face might have still been possible for Nasser. Having satisfied himself with a show of strength, the Egyptian president could have ordered his divisions back to Cairo, and that would have left the impression that they had forestalled a Zionist attack. But his government's challenge to Outant and Outant's instant capitulation signified the point of no return. To his own astonishment, Nasser had won a brilliant victory by scarcely raising his little finger. Once again, he was on the threshold of becoming the unchallenged leader of the Arab world. On May 19th, Egyptian units were reinforcing their former garrisons at Sharm el-Sheikh, while in Gaza, Ahmed Zoukeri's Palestinian army, consisting mainly of refugees, was preparing to occupy the border encampments that up until then had been manned by the UNEF. On May 20th, a general Israeli mobilization was proclaimed. The next day, on the 21st, Nasser made a chilling announcement, quote, "The Strait of Tehran is part of our territorial waters. No Israeli ship will ever navigate it again. We also forbid the shipment of strategic materiel to Israel in non-Israeli vessels." Suddenly, we had a mortal threat to Israel. Eilat was Israel's key oil port. By noon, May 23rd, mobilization in Israel had become total. On May 23rd, after Nasser had closed the Straits of Tehran, General Rabin, Yitzhak Rabin, was overcome with despair at the government's indecision, and he suffered a nervous breakdown. The Army medical officer prescribed rest for 2 or 3 days until the chief of staff recovered from his collapse. It was officially attributed to nicotine poisoning. In effect, the nation and its armed forces were without decisive leadership at one of its gravest moments, perhaps the very gravest moments of Israel's existence. So at this point, there arose a growing clamor for Moshe Dayan to become the Minister of Defense. On June 1st, Israel's Prime Minister, Levi Eshkol, gave the defense ministry to Moshe Dayan. He was very popular. He was very trusted. In fact, trust in this very famous one-eyed general was overwhelming. News of his appointment immediately restored the confidence of the armed forces and the nation at large. Now, in the Arab world, Nasser was euphoric over the revived adulation that he received from the Arab world. He addressed the Arab parliament on May 25th, quote, "The problem presently before the Arab countries is not whether the port of Eilat should be blockaded or how to blockade it, but how to totally exterminate the state of Israel for all time." That was his view. It wasn't this blockading the port was just a small stuff in his point of view. The ultimate goal that Nasser had in mind was to exterminate, to destroy the state of Israel. On May 30th, Hussein of Jordan, King Hussein of Jordan, flew to Cairo to sign a mutual defense pact with Egypt. He treated photographers to the spectacle of himself and Nasser embracing each other in brotherly friendship. You see, the little Hashemite monarch dared not abstain from joining an undertaking that was sweeping the entire Arab world. It was an undertaking that seemed very likely at last to annihilate the Zionist enemy. On June 3rd, Iraq also joined the military pact. And the following night, an Iraqi motorized brigade crossed into Jordan. At the same time, the Iraqi Air Force concentrated its planes at the Habaniya Air Base near the Jordanian frontier. Now, when Yitzhak Rabin became chief of staff in 1964, a couple years before this, when he became chief of staff, he testified before the Knesset Security and Foreign Affairs Committee that any future war would have to be won in 4 days. It could not take substantially longer for economic reasons. And the implications for Israel was the fact that Israel needed to attack preemptively. Yet, to avoid alienating world opinion, the nation was left with no recourse but to allow the enemy to mobilize, allow the enemy to gather on Israel's border, allow the enemy to proclaim to the world that this time the Jews would be liquidated, and then the proper time would be to strike out of the enemy with an anticipatory counteroffensive. Strike at the last possible moment. On June 1st, Foreign Minister Abba Ibn informed Prime Minister Eshkol that no political purpose would be served in delaying military action any longer. At 7:10 p.m. on June 5th, Major General Mordechai Chod, the commander of Israel's Air Force, General Mordechai Chod, radioed the attack order from the operations room in the Defense Ministry in Tel Aviv. And once he did that, the world's most skilled air arm was launched into action. Israeli pilots and ground crews were considered the equal of any in the world. They had near-perfect intelligence. And thanks to that near-perfect intelligence, the Israeli command had pinpointed the location of virtually all of the Egyptian planes, all anti-aircraft batteries, and even wooden dummy planes that the Egyptians had. They knew when the Egyptian pilots flew their morning patrols, when they launched, and when they landed for their morning coffee break. Everything had been studied, prepared, and rehearsed innumerable times before the final day. And now the first Israeli planes took off. They took off in staggered intervals for Egypt's key air bases in the Sinai Peninsula, in the Suez Rectangle, and in the Nile Valley. The two engine Vautour light bombers were assigned the furthest target, which was Luxor on the Nile. The single engine Mirage headed for the nearest fields at El Arish, the others in the Sinai. All were scheduled to arrive over their targets at the identical moment, 7:45 a.m. Israeli time. The pilots were ordered first to destroy the Egyptian bombers and interceptors and then devastate the air bases. So taking off over the Mediterranean, the planes hooked back over Egypt at near ground level to avoid enemy radar. Reaching their 11 separate targets at the appointed time, the Israelis climbed high and then dived to 200 feet as they proceeded to attack. The Egyptian fighters were taxiing to a halt after returning from their morning patrol. The anti-aircraft crews were also caught away from their positions. The Israelis made 4 passes over their targets, consuming their allotted 7 minutes to destroy the enemy planes, and then to rocket and bomb the Egyptian airfields. 10 minutes after the first attack came the second attack wave, and 10 minutes after that came a third. And as the Israelis streaked for home, they managed to evade a number of surface-to-air missiles that climbed up after them. In 170 minutes, Israel's pilots had smashed Egypt's best-equipped air bases and turned 300 of Nasser's 340 combat planes into flaming wrecks. Another 20 Egyptian planes were shot down in the air. When the returning Israeli jets touched down and their pilots debriefed, the news of their success was received with disbelief and skepticism. It just didn't seem possible. General Hoad admitted later, quote, "In my wildest dreams, I would have never thought this kind of record possible. I reckoned on at least half a day to complete the job, maybe even a whole night, or a night and a day. And it all took just a few minutes. The Egyptian Air Force, the largest in the Middle East, was in ruins. And now the Israelis were free to concentrate on the Egyptian ground armies. Indeed, throughout the next few days, the Air Force roamed at will over the Sinai, destroying entire convoys of armor and other vehicles fleeing to the canal. On 8:15 on June 5th, the Israeli ground forces attacked. By the end of the second day of battle, after 35 hours of uninterrupted war, the first and most difficult phase of the Israeli operational plan had been completed. Egyptian fortifications had been penetrated and bypassed. The Sinai was open wide for Israeli armor. The roads to the west and the south were clear. Throughout the first day of the Sinai offensive, the Israeli government refrained from issuing announcements regarding the magnitude of the victories. The only military communiques that went out over the airwaves were broadcast by Cairo. Egypt were the only one using the airwaves. And during the first 24 hours, these releases spoke of unprecedented Egyptian breakthroughs. They spoke of the Israeli army and air force being destroyed, and of Egyptian mechanized columns driving on Tel Aviv. This news was accepted without question everywhere in the Arab world. It influenced the decisions of Syria, Jordan, and Iraq to enter the fighting. When the hostilities began on June 5th, the Syrians, at the last minute, adopted a wait-and-see attitude and preferred simply to shell the Galilee town of Rosh Pina and its neighboring settlements. Israeli artillery kept up a vigorous reply to the Syrian barrage. By late afternoon of June 5th, the Israeli Air Force had all but eradicated the Syrian air arm, and it was apparent to Damascus that it had been misinformed regarding the extent of the Egyptian victories. Deprived, then, of the opportunity to embark on a major offensive, the Syrian regime made its second mistake and continued hostilities on a local scale. On June 6th, the Syrian Infantry and Armored Company, or I should say a Syrian infantry and armored company, launched 2 attacks on Tel Dan and one on Kibbutz Sha'ar Yishuv, and they were repelled by Israeli tank and air units. And the Syrians would pay bitterly for this miscalculation, this attack. The Jordanian blunder was even more catastrophic. King Hussein received an urgent message from Prime Minister Eshkol appealing to Hussein to refrain from entering the war. The Israeli leader promised that his own government would not initiate hostilities along the Eastern Front. However, shooting from the Jordanian positions at the southern end of Jerusalem broke out on mid-morning of June 5th. The Jordanians, it was hoped, were simply interested in making a show, a gesture, to remain in Nasser's good graces. To ensure that they entertained no serious ambitions, the Israeli Air Force commenced bombing runs on the Amman and Mafraq airfields at 12:30 p.m. They liquidated the entire Jordanian fighter fleet. By 1 o'clock, either by prearrangement or for some other reason, Arab Legion forces crossed the Jerusalem armistice lines and occupied the UN headquarters on the Hill of Evil Council. From the larger military viewpoint, the seizure of the Hill of Evil Council was Hussein's gravest error. He failed to detect the power of Israeli air squadrons over Amman when Egypt was boasting that virtually all Israel's planes had been destroyed. But he didn't figure it out. His air force had just been destroyed by the Israelis, and yet somehow he didn't figure out that the Egyptian boast was incorrect. So now Israel is fighting on three fronts. She's fighting on the Egyptian front, she's fighting on the Syrian front, and she's fighting on the Jordanian front. Okay, so let's take a look at what's happening back on the Egyptian front in the Sinai. On June 6th, the Egyptian High Command ordered its troops to fall back to the second line of defense in the Sinai. And Israel then launched a coordinated attack at dawn on June 7. In the ensuing armored battles, all in flat terrain, the highly skilled Israeli tankers annihilated their opponents. In the end, more than 800 Egyptian tanks were knocked out or captured. At the same time, another conquest proved very easy. On June 7th, Sharm el-Sheikh, the Egyptian coastal fortress overlooking the Strait of Tehran, fell without any resistance. Now, the greater part of the Egyptian army was smashed in the desert behind them, and so the Israelis pressed on ahead for the canal. On June 8th, the Israeli troops had reached Al-Kantara and destroyed the remaining Egyptian armor there. And the victory was a staggering one. Seven Egyptian divisions totaling 100,000 men had been crushed in less than 4 days. At 1 p.m. on June 8th, Fedorenko of the Soviet Union introduced a ceasefire resolution at the UN. The resolution was passed unanimously. Israeli UN ambassador Abba Ibn declared that Israel would abide by its terms provided the Arab states indicated agreement. Nasser accepted the resolution. Now let's move up to the Jordanian front. Israel's fighting against Jordan, against Syria, and now Egypt has capitulated. But let's take a look at the Jordanian front. The Jordanian troops occupied Government House on the afternoon of June 5th and proceeded to shell the small Israeli detachment on Mount Scopus. At this point, with Moshe Dayan's approval, Rabin issued orders to General Narkis, retake Government House, link up with Scopus, and protect the Jerusalem high ground by any means. A company of troops set about ascending the Hill of Evil Council, and by mid-afternoon the operation was completed with the loss of eight dead. Simultaneously, a paratroop brigade under the command of General Mordechai Gur was reassigned from its intended Sinai destination and transported by bus from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Gur's instructions were to attack Jordanian fortifications on the perimeter of the Arab city and then move against the legionnaires atop the heights of Mount Scopus. The attack began at 2:20 a.m. on June 6th. The first prong of the attack was Ammunition Hill. There, the legionnaires fought heroically, and positions had to be stormed trench by trench in a fierce and costly battle. The second prong of the attack was launched from the Mea Shearim quarter, directly against the Mandelbaum Gate. And once more, fighting was intense. It raged from street to street and from house to house. But with the support of tanks, the paratroopers completed the action by dawn. Rabin then ordered his general to launch a coordinated pincer movement through the West Bank. By late morning of June 7, ravaged by the aerial strafing and the bombing, Jordan's 25th Infantry and 40th Armored Brigades collapsed as fighting units. All the major cities of the West Bank were in Israel's hands. Israeli armored columns had likewise reached the Jordan River. At 8:30 on June 7th, 8:30 in the morning on June 7th, 1967, Gur ordered an infantry attack against the final remaining Jordanian high point overlooking Jerusalem. It was the Augusta Victoria Church, and it fell rather easily. Immediately afterward, the paratroops launched a tank and infantry assault against the Lion's Gate, one of the principal entrances of the old city. They entered the old city, and they rolled up the narrow Via Dolorosa, and the column made directly for the ancient Temple Mount. And then the paratroopers dashed for the western wall to clear it of snipers. The firing had not yet stopped around the western wall before Rabbi Shlomo Goren, chief chaplain of the Israeli army, rushed to the holy site to loose a triumphant blast on the shofar. Dayan, Rabin, and Eshkol soon followed. They were dazed and awestruck by the recovery. Touching the flagstones of the ancient western wall, even hardened, battle-hardened veterans wept. Now, the final decision awaiting the government was the action against Syria, the Syrian front, the third front. At 3 a.m. on June 9, Moshe Dayan was informed that the Egyptian and Jordanian ceasefires had come into effect. And so now it was time to move against the northern enemy, the third frontier, the Syrian front. Israel's strategy was to crack the main fortifications, to move onto roads behind the Syrians, and they figured the enemy would panic. And the strategy proved entirely correct. The morale of the Syrian army was shattered irretrievably when its troops began fleeing for their lives. At 5:30 p.m. on June 9th, the Syrian representative in the Security Council announced that his government had ordered an end to the fighting in compliance with the UN ceasefire resolution. Within half an hour, similar orders had gone out to Israeli armed forces on the northern front. However, Israel maintained their drive with the intention of taking the entire Golan. At the Defense Ministry in Tel Aviv, tension was growing as the Golan offensive raced the UN ceasefire deadline. The Israeli drive was successful, and the entire Golan Heights was taken. And the Six-Day War ended officially at 6:30 p.m. Israel time on June 10, 1967. The results was a new military geographic reality in the Middle East. Before the war, the main Israeli population center had lain within 4 minutes flying time of the nearest Arab airbase. Any Arab land offensive into Israel, except in the southern Negev, would have affected thickly inhabited areas. Much of Israel's narrow waistline had fallen within Arab artillery range. The Jewish population of Jerusalem and the northern Galilee settlements were within Arab artillery range. But now, after the war of 1967, the situation was reversed. Now it was Israeli planes and troops that were within close striking distance of Amman, Damascus, and Cairo. The Jewish Jerusalem was no longer on the firing line, nor was the Galilee, nor was any other Israeli population center. However, bickering and belligerent incidents continued, and the UN tried to hammer out an acceptable diplomatic formula for all sides. And the diplomatic results of the Six-Day War is UN Security Council Resolution 242. The result came on November 22, 1967, UN Resolution 242. I'd like to read two basic statements that outline the basic principles of UN Resolution 242. First of all, UN Resolution 242 does not require Israel to return to the non-secure borders of pre-1967. This is the overriding principle of UN Resolution 242. Now, Arthur J. Goldberg, he was one of the authors of UN Resolution 242. He was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations in 1965 through 1967. This was his assessment of 242. He says, and I quote, "It calls for respect and acknowledgement of the sovereignty of every state in the area, Since Israel never denied the sovereignty of its neighboring countries, this language obviously requires those countries to acknowledge Israel's sovereignty. So the Arab states are required to recognize the existence of the State of Israel. This statement was made by Dr. Goldberg on June 10, 1977. Eugene V. Rostow, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs from 1966 to 1969, said this: Security Council Resolution 242 rests on two principles. Israel may administer the territory until its Arab neighbors make peace, and when peace is made, Israel should withdraw to secure and recognize borders, which does not need to be the same as the armistice demarcation lines of 1949. In other words, 242 does not demand that Israel return to a state of insecurity. Israel's security needs are acknowledged. Well, I see we've run out of time for this lesson. We've managed to get the Six-Day War under our belt. Let's bring this lesson to a close, and we'll pick it up with lesson number 14 and the 1968 War of Attrition.
Thank you, Pastor Bob. It's our aim at Heart of Our Messianic Ministries to deepen your understanding of God's Word and to better equip you to share the Messiahship of Jesus with your Jewish friends, relatives, co-workers, and neighbors. To order additional tapes or for more information, you can contact Heart of Our Messianic Ministries at hadavar@hadavar.org. That's hadavar@hadavar.org. Or write to Heart of Our Messianic Ministries at 14804 Sand Canyon Avenue, Irvine, California, 92618. Or simply call us at 949-559-1701. Again, that number is 949-559-1701. Again, thanks for listening to this audio presentation of the First Regathering Modern Israel, brought to you by Heart of Our Messianic Ministries. If you're listening to this class on audio tape, please turn the tape over to begin the next lesson. If you're listening to this class on CD, the next lesson will begin in a moment.